Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
What's going to happen in November? I mean, is a lot of people going to be stuck out here, or do they have arrangements?
Homeless residents at an Anchorage campground wonder about their future. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, rain may be dampening Alaska's fire season, but officials say it's not over yet.
In our previous large acreage years, we would have our typical lull this time of year, only to have it dry out in August and September.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Roughly 200 houseless people are staying at Anchorage's Centennial Park, and advocates are worried about whether they're receiving the resources and care they need. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early visited the campground this week and has more on concerns over supplies, safety, and a timeline for establishing a permanent shelter.
Raindrops tap on a tarp above as James Keel and Jimmy Hartley sit around a bench Monday morning working to boil some water for coffee using a makeshift burner and some kerosene.
The air pushes the fuel to the burner.
There it goes.
It's like a Coleman.
There she goes.
At the end of June, the city closed the mass shelter at the Sullivan Arena and began moving the people who were staying there to various locations, including the campground. The mayor's office insists that the campground is not a part of the city's response to homelessness. Roger Branson chairs the Anchorage Houseless Resources Advocacy Council. The group has been staffing a tent at the campground with food, water, and other resources. Last week, Branson said campers found conditions to be, quote, deplorable. He says conditions have improved since then.
A very positive conversation that I did have with the mayor was the explanation that it's not what I perceive or what he perceives, it's what the people in the camp perceive and how they're viewing life.
One immediate change Branson noted over the weekend was the lifting of the city's burn ban. He says Parks and Rec officials began distributing firewood to campers.
So for the campers themselves, psychologically, that was a huge deal, to be able to have fires to gather around socially and to dry out.
Safety has been a concern for both volunteers and the campers using the area. Anchorage police were called to the campground Sunday night due to a fight between two men. A police spokeswoman said officers ended up using a stun gun multiple times on one of the men after he attacked police. The man was taken into custody, and Branson said he's happy things didn't escalate beyond that.
I was really concerned because the campers themselves were looking to defend themselves with what they could. And, you know, the clubs and knives and stuff like that were getting brandished, and we were able to nip that in the bud, and it was a community effort, so I'm really pleased about that.
Additionally, Branson says a camp resident died Thursday night from an overdose. Anchorage police say the woman was found unresponsive and had been given Narcan. Branson says several other people overdosed the same day, but they recovered after receiving Narcan. Corey Allen Young, a spokesman with the mayor's office, says the city is working to address safety concerns with 24/7 security at the campground. Bean's Cafe was on site handing out food, but the future availability for basic services is up in the air since the mayor's administration hasn't said how long homeless people will stay at the campground. Bean's Cafe Executive Director Lisa Souter says funding to serve food has all come from donations.
We can continue to seek support from the general community and from businesses, and that's something, you know, that we're doing right now. But at some point, you know, to sustain it, if it is going to be a longer-term effort, we would certainly welcome some additional funding from another source.
Mayor Dave Bronson announced Tuesday that the Salvation Army would be handling on-site client care at the campground. That includes connecting people with various resources, including food, case management, supplies, and donations. That's after the city's Homeless Prevention Response System Advisory Council said it wouldn't make those connections anymore, citing safety concerns and the fact that the campground isn't part of the official city homelessness response. While safety continues to be an issue, overall campers have mixed results when it comes to getting basic needs met. Keel, the camper from earlier, says assistance from the city has been hit or miss. On the one hand, he says Mayor Bronson personally helped him get supplies.
The mayor was like, do you need something? I was like, well, I need some rope. And then he was like, well, hang on. And I went in there and looked for it, couldn't find it, and then went to the store and personally bought me some and had his whoever brought it back to me.
On the other hand, he feels that sometimes security is very strict. Keel has been a regular at the camp for a month and says when he tried to enter the camp 4 minutes past the closing time Sunday night, he was refused.
That needs to be addressed, I think, because it's like long people like me that's been here, they either give me a tag in the window and I can come. I mean, it's not like I'm out like all night. I mean, it was like I was coming back from the grocery store. I mean, it was like, really? Come on.
Keel ended up spending the night in his car. He says he's hoping to leave soon and plans to meet with local housing agencies so he can get surgery for his back that he's put off. But other campers, like Rodney Reeves, say they're concerned for people with longer-term stays.
What's going to happen in November? I mean, is a lot of people going to be stuck out here, or do they have arrangements? You know, last year, the Sullivan knew that it was going to be closing. So why wasn't arrangements made then?
The city currently has a plan for a navigation center and shelter to open on Tudor Road. Young says it will be open in the fall, but couldn't give a more specific timeline. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The Alaska Beacon reports former Governor Bill Walker has raised more money over the past 5 months than any other candidate in this year's race to be Alaska's governor. But Walker is heading toward the August 16th primary election with less cash in his campaign war chest than Republican candidate and incumbent governor Mike Dunleavy. Walker, an independent, raised $832,000 between February 2nd and July 15th, according to new filings with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Dunleavy reported raising $762,000, while Democratic candidate Les Guerra reported raising $484,000. All three men are seeking to be among the top four finishers in the upcoming primary. 10 people are running for governor this year, and the four candidates who receive the most votes will advance to the November general election. Voters will be asked to pick one candidate in August, and then in November will rank the four finalists in order of preference. Charlie Pierce, the Kenai Peninsula borough mayor running for governor as a Republican, reported raising $64,000, while Christopher Kirka, a Republican state legislator from Wasilla, reported raising $12,000. The cool, rainy weather that set in last week over much of Alaska has dampened this year's fire season, which was shaping up to be one of the worst in recorded history. And although state and federal agencies are sending some crews home, officials warned that the fires could come roaring back after a day or two of dry, warm weather. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Hot and dry weather earlier this summer created the perfect storm for wildfires that have burned nearly 3 million acres in Alaska this year, making it the sixth worst fire season on record. In response, agencies have mobilized 2,000 firefighters and equipment from around the state and outside, and they were about to raise the state's fire preparedness rating to its highest level.
We're at 4 now, 5 is the top. Last week and the week before, we were planning level 5.
State Forestry Division spokesperson Sam Harrell says all that changed over the past week or so after thunderstorms that had been spawning only dry lightning finally began to produce rain.
Tomorrow morning, Alaska will be dropping back to a preparedness level of 3.
In response to the change in weather, officials reduced the fire danger level in many areas and lifted the statewide emergency burn ban. And Harrell says some of the elite fire incident management teams brought up from the states are preparing to pack up and head home.
Fire season is picking up in the lower 48, and there is a demand for resources. And so once they're done with their assignment in Alaska, we are demobilizing them back to the lower 48 or back to Canada, depending on where they've come from.
That's what's happening with the Lime Complex, a series of 18 wildfires that have burned more than 865,000 acres in southwest Alaska. Harrell says forestry officials also hope to soon take over management of the 38,000-acre Minto Lakes fire northwest of Fairbanks. And he says management of the 61,000-acre Middle Tanana Complex fires burning between Salcha and Delta Junction also is downsizing.
The fires aren't growing anymore. And so the management team there has moved to a smaller group from a type 2 incident management team to a type 3.
The cool weather has slowed the 72,000-acre Clear Fire that's burning west of Anderson. And Harrell says officials there want to take the opportunity to limit the fire's growth.
They're still dealing with some active portions of line on that fire. And as crews are not needed on some of these other fires, we're rerouting them to Clear.
He says fire officials remain cautious because they know it's possible that hot and dry weather could return. He says that's happened in fire seasons past that look a lot like this one.
In our previous large acreage years, that's how those summers played out. We would have our typical lull this time of year, only to have it dry out in August and September.
Harrell says the fire season is only half over, and forestry will keep busy suppressing high-priority wildfires well into the fall. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, low salmon runs leave rural Alaskans without a major food source.
Growing up, I think we really took it for granted that there was always, you know, some fish returning here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Most businesses in Southeast Alaska say a lack of workforce housing is hurting their economic outlook. For some, it's a major barrier to success. That's according to a recent survey of 440 businesses in the region. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
The annual survey looks at how businesses are faring in the region. And while they're generally optimistic after two pandemic years, the region still faces economic headwinds. In this year's survey, 72% of respondents indicated that housing is their number one problem.
We've just been struggling.
Jaylene Owen is with the Hames Corporation in Sitka, where a region-high 88% of businesses say a lack of workforce housing is weighing on profits. The family-owned company has several stores from groceries to gas and employs 150 people. Many are renters on a fixed income, and that's a big challenge.
There's just no place to rent. My employees were leaving me and telling me things like, I can't afford to live here.
At the worst point last year, Hames had 40 open jobs it couldn't fill. Owen says the corporation has tried to sweeten the deal for workers. They've given three raises in the last year and a half and might offer a fourth. They've also beefed up the employee discount, taking a hit on their own profits. But they're still stretched thin.
I have employees that are pulling 120 hours of payroll. Because they put in 40 hours of overtime on top of their 80 because there's no workers here.
I don't see a solution.
That's Scott Wagner, manager of NSERA, Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. It's a nonprofit that runs salmon hatcheries that supplement stocks in Southeast. And it's based in Sitka.
We have two different housing issues, I guess. One is we have this peak need in the summer, which is hard to find short-term housing in the summertime in Sitka. That's really hard. But then the long-term housing issue is employees, especially entry-level employees, being able to find affordable housing for the year.
NSERA employs 30 to 55 people, depending on the season, and they provide bunk housing for some of them. Wagner says he's running into the same issue as a lot of regional employers.
I'm trying to think how many times, you know, we had a position come open, made an offer somebody, and then they tell us a week later, you know what, I just looked into it, I can't afford to move there.
Housing isn't the only economic problem affecting the workforce. Affordable childcare is another one. The pandemic and inflation have also been a big hit to economic prospects. But housing should be a solvable problem, says Robert Venables. He's the executive director for the Regional Economic Development Organization, Southeast Conference, which commissioned the survey.
The housing shortage and challenges is so pervasive that it's impacting almost every single economic sector. It doesn't matter if you're in tourism or construction or healthcare or retail. Everybody is struggling not only for the workers, but a place to put them if you can find them.
It's a complicated issue. Most towns in Southeast are on rocky mountainous islands with limited road systems. There are only so many places to build. The region also relies heavily on summer tourism, which means more housing is needed for seasonal workers. But short-term rentals are also taken up by tourists themselves. Still, an answer to the housing problem is needed, says Venables.
That is definitely a challenge that has to be addressed if we're going to thrive as a region.
But so far, solutions are elusive. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
As food insecurity surges nationally, rural Alaskans at the intersection of food scarcity and climate change are facing a tough reality. In the Chignik region, low salmon returns are leaving the community without a vital food source. In response, one Sitka-based organization is leading the initiative to provide fish for families in need. KCAW's Tosh Kimmel reports.
As a child, George Anderson would spend his summers fishing in Chignik Lagoon, a remote Alaska Native village 400 miles southwest of Anchorage. For him and the rest of the Chignik community, salmon is more than just a food source.
You know, fish has been, you know, it is a part of your life and your identity. Growing up, I think we really took it for granted that there was always, you know, some fish returning here.
As salmon runs dry up across western Alaska, many in Chignik have been struggling to fill their freezers and smokehouses over the last few years.
About 2018, when we did not meet our escapement goals for our early or late run, that's when people really, really started getting concerned.
Anderson is the president of the Chignik Intertribal Coalition, an advocacy alliance created in response to the 2018 salmon collapse. But in the last 4 years, the shortage of fish has persisted.
In Chignik, there are two very distinct sockeye runs, an early run and a late run, and neither returned in 18, 19, 20, and 21.
There's no telling when or even if the Chignik sockeye stock will return, but the dwindling supply comes with grave economic and cultural implications. Anderson says now is the time to act if they want to preserve their way of life.
It's just really nice to be able to pass down to our kids and grandkids the way we prepare fish and store it for the winter.
And also to ensure future food security.
There's so many different stressors on our food web. In the face of climate change, it's just very important to set up these food sharing networks.
The Fish to Families Initiative is a grassroots effort to aid communities facing food scarcity across Alaska. The program is becoming an integral part of a food supply network, sourcing and transporting thousands of pounds of fish to four communities in the Chignik area. But organizers have been working to raise more funding so they can serve other regions.
And then we're going to be focused hopefully on some communities on the Yukon and the upper to mid section and some of the coastal regions if possible.
That's Natalie Sattler, the program director with Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, or ALFA, the organization behind Fish to Families. The initiative started as a fish donation program in response to pandemic-related food insecurity and a struggling seafood industry. But Sattler says 2 years later, the need remains.
This is not just a result of the pandemic, that there are these real issues that we want to help address.
Sattler says the project is looking to capitalize on the abundance of other fisheries in the state. To fund and transport the fish, ALFA has partnered with a handful of processors, fishermen, and other organizations. For every $24 donated, one salmon is delivered to a family.
We know that there's, you know, these projected record-breaking salmon runs in Bristol Bay. How can we leverage that or use that abundance to feed these other areas? So kind of Alaskans feeding Alaskans.
The project is currently relying on volunteers, charitable donations, and federal grants to survive. But because it's not entirely clear why Chignik stocks have been so consistently low, the need may be ongoing. And it's not an isolated event. Sattler says they hope to expand to other communities, specifically in the Yukon-Kiskakwim region, where chum and Chinook runs are also suffering.
What we've seen recently has been just dramatically, dramatically poor.
That's Katie Howard, fishery scientist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and lead researcher with the Salmon Ocean Ecology Program. She says declining salmon stocks could have something to do with a warming ocean.
We've seen a lot of drought and really warm temperatures in the river, especially in 2019. And in the ocean, we've seen these really big marine heat waves that have spanned many consecutive years, and they've just been really large geographically and really unlike anything that's ever been seen before.
While Howard's research has focused primarily on the health of chum and Chinook, she says more data on the Chignik sockeye's life cycle is coming in the next year.
One of the things that we're hoping to get started next year is a survey in marine waters to get the same kinds of data we have for the Yukon that would also collect information on juvenile Chignik salmon and really zero in on what might be responsible.
While the future of Western Alaska salmon runs looks pretty uncertain, organizers of Fish for Families are working to ensure that at least people in Chignik won't go without fish this summer. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The main artery between Fairbanks and Valdez opened Monday after being closed a week due to flooding. KUAC's Robin reports the Richardson Highway is open but still has lots of damage.
Department of Transportation spokeswoman Danielle Tesson says the Richardson Highway from milepost 218 to 234 has been closed since last Monday when torrential rains washed out pavement or underlayment in several places of the highway.
It's been pretty incredible. Our crews went in and they had to identify all the areas in which had damage to our infrastructure.
Tesson says the worst damage was under a 70-year-old bridge at milepost 233 south of Black Rapids.
The Bear Creek Bridge area had the most impact, and the road actually completely washed out at that bridge, causing this closure to be a little bit longer because we had to rebuild the road.
The closure was actually shorter than many people expected, considering the damage. Tesson says day and night work brought earth and material to the site to rebuild the road.
We've got a couple different contractors and our maintenance and operation crews all working collectively together and really around the clock just to get this response going through the rain against Mother Nature. And as of Sunday, the 17th, we were able to open the road around noon to single lane traffic.
A pilot car will guide traffic through the area where crews are working at Bear Creek and six other sites along the highway.
We have crews that are going to be actively working. Some of that work is going to be cleaning out culverts, working in the ditches, but we also have a ton of work still happening at Bear Creek. The road is open, so we have pilot car operations, we have flaggers, and you can anticipate to show up there and have to probably wait for a period of time. But the good news is you can get through now.
The flooding also damaged a fiber optic cable, limiting cell phone and internet service throughout the region. That bridge, along with others, has been on a DOT replacement schedule even before the washout. The project is currently in the design stage and scheduled to start construction in 2025. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The Inuit Circumpolar Council's three-day meeting of its General Assembly began today. The non-governmental organization represents more than 180,000 Inuit across the Arctic. As Emily Schwing reports, the meeting only happens once every 4 years, and this year, complications related to COVID-19 are forcing delegates to meet in a hybrid format.
When the Inuit Circumpolar Council last met in Utqiagvik in 2018,
Members from Alaska, Greenland, Northern Canada, and Chukotka in Russia set goals to address climate change and the impacts of increasing industrial maritime traffic in the Arctic. Since then, the ICC has gained provisional status within the International Maritime Organization, or IMO. It's a United Nations agency that sets international maritime law. An ICC status within the IMO is a first for an indigenous organization. Daley Sambo Durow is the current ICC chair.
With the changing conditions across the Arctic Ocean, we felt it was necessary to gain status or consultative status within the IMO as an indigenous peoples organization to really advance our autonomous or independent voice within the IMO.
ICC has also become the first indigenous peoples organization to gain observer status within the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
And this is huge in terms of the impacts of climate change across our homelands and our traditional territory, including the coastal seas and sea ice.
Ahead of this week's meeting, the ICC released new standards aimed at scientists, researchers, and policymakers. The new protocols lay out expectations from ICC members on how best to engage in work that takes place on Inuit homelands across the Arctic. Because the coronavirus continues to complicate travel, delegates will gather in various locations within their respective home countries to attend a meeting together, but virtually. Greenland will assume the ICC chairmanship through 2026. An in-person gathering is set to be held there next summer. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
There was a rare whale sighting off the coast of Unalaska near Makushin Bay last month. A dead beaked whale had floated up. That's a type of deep water species people rarely get the chance to see. They live in cold ocean waters more than 3,000 feet down, so when a beaked whale makes its way to the surface, even a dead one, it gives scientists an opportunity to learn about the species. Mandy Keough is the Alaska Regional Stranding Coordinator for the Marine Mammal Stranding Network.
The reason they're called beaked is they kind of have this elongated mouth area, and they often will feed on squid and other animals, and they're very deep divers, and we don't know a lot about them.
The U.S. Coast Guard spotted the whale and reported it to the 24-hour hotline. The hotline is part of a statewide program run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. People can call in to report animals that are caught in fishing nets or stranded on beaches, or in the case of the beaked whale, floating in the water. If the animal is injured, local volunteers will do what they can to help. If it's dead, they'll take measurements and samples. Keough says this helps researchers learn about individual animals and monitor populations.
We use the photos to determine the species, also whether there's any signs of killer whale predation or other trauma that may occur. And if we have Stranding Network volunteers in the area and it's accessible, we would reach out to them, and then they would go out to the actual carcass and they would collect a number of measurements as well as samples.
You can report stranded, injured, and dead marine mammals to the 24-hour stranding hotline at 877-925-7773. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Emily Schwing in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Angela Denny in Petersburg, Tosh Kimmel in Sitka, Robin in Fairbanks, and Laura Lynn Cruz in Unalaska. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.